So, welcome to the beginnings of winter in Northeast Ohio. Who got snow over the weekend? Yeah. So, lecture 22, November 14th. Lecture notes page is 202. We're going to start off by welcoming Teresa Wallace from our International Programs office in the College of Business. Teresa is going to talk to us a little bit about some of those things we've been hearing about, which is the study abroad programs. And here's Teresa, and here's your mouse to click.
Thank you.
And then pop up the square, the top square. There you go.
Hi. As he said, I'm Teresa Wallace. I'm the director of the International Programs Office for the Ambassador Crawford College of Business and Entrepreneurship. Even if you're not a business student, you might want to pay attention. You might be getting a marketing minor or international business minor or any of our several minors in business. So there's two study abroad opportunities over spring break that I want to tell you about, and then there's two in the summer I'll tell you about too. And summer for marketing, one is for management majors and CIS majors, and one of them is for economics. So this first one is spring break, and it's offered over the 10 days over spring break. It's the International Marketing and Entrepreneurship Business Excellence and Made in Italy. So some people can't get away for a semester or even for a month in the summer, then this is for you. It's also one of the cheaper ways to study abroad because you don't pay any extra tuition if you're going over the spring term. If you're already a full-time student, you've already paid for the same tuition if you're 12 to 18 hours. So most people are around 15 hours every semester. You either include that in that 15 or go to 18, and you don't have any extra tuition to pay. So this is over spring break, and it counts for both marketing and entrepreneurship students. If you're not one of those majors, then if you're business management, you could fit it into that major, and also general business, any other major, you could fit it into general electives. And again, it can go to some of your minors in business too. So the dates again are March 24th through April 1st. All the information that you want to know is on here. There's a short description of the program. It shows you the course numbers and the CRN, but you would have to apply. The application is right on here. You don't have to fly with a group. The leader from the Kent campus is Denise Lee. She's an entrepreneurship lecturer. There's an instructor there named Simone Anselmi, and he's part of the Florence curriculum. So he's a regular instructor in the regular semesters. So if you're interested in that one, this is on the Office of Global Education's webpage. Let me go back. Okay, thank you. All right, this one is the management or computer information systems major elective course. It's led by Dr. Pradham Dada. He teaches both management and computer information systems courses. So this would count as a major elective for either one of those. It's March 25th through April 1st. There's a little bit of a course description here and course information with the CRNs. And again, you apply here. There's cost information on all of these. This one is pretty economical too. These are the fees. The one for Florence is a few hundred dollars less, but you have to add in the flights. The flights are on your own, or you could go with the instructor on their flight and they'll provide the flight information. If you don't want to fly to Europe by yourself, you don't have
we'll assume the battery died, so
I'll just hold it. All right. So anyway, the estimated total here is 3743. So this is important if you, again, are looking for an economical way to go. The spring break ones are it. The ones in the summer are a couple thousand more because they include tuition for the summer. So there's two more. These are the summer ones. So this one's going to Greece. It's a marketing course. It's with Ellen Daniels. The date's May 22nd to June 4th. And again, this one costs a little bit more, but a lot of students go on this one. It's in the summer, and you might not be available to go over spring break or in the regular semester. There's one more. There's an econ one. This one is actually going to go to an economic conference. And this might not sound exciting to you if you're not econ, but the instructor is very friendly and outgoing. Her name is Luda Leontieva. You might have her from one of your economics classes. It's in the summer, and it's only 1 week in Ireland. So she has a few information sessions ahead of that you would need to attend. And then the main part of it is only 1 week. So if you can only get away for a week, it's May 26th through June 3rd. And let's click on the costs for that one. So there's a cost for that one. All right, so I'm in room 300E in business. If you want to come in and ask me more questions or send me an email at twallace@kent.edu. All right, thanks, Dr. Martin.
Well, thank you so much, Teresa. Thanks a lot. There you go. Like a hand round of applause for Teresa and all the international travel experience. I will have this slide up, as I always do, part of the housekeeping slide, so it will be on Canvas. If you want to click on anything she clicked on, you'll be able to pull it up and follow up on it from those slides. Yeah? Good. So, what's new here that we haven't seen before? Mini test 10 closed on Saturday. 96% of the students took it. The score is right around where it usually is, 87%. We know midterm 2 is open, closing tomorrow via proctorio at 6 p.m. And on our regular schedule, not to be daunted, mini test 11 will open tomorrow, covering last Wednesday and today's class on our regular schedule. Enhanced learning and extra credit for number 7. It's already been posted, so those students so far have added 1.8 or 9% to the final course grade, and it will open on the regular schedule. 156 students got 0.5% added to their final course grade for participation in research extra credit number 2. If you have any questions on why you participated but didn't get credit, contact the researcher. It has something to do with her attention checks, and not everybody got them right. So she said, obviously, you didn't really participate. So, but she did update after talking to some students several scores for us. We know about midterm 2. We know all about it. Any questions on midterm 2 at this late date stage of the game? As you know, sometimes I get over-enthused about a topic. So today's business in the news had to do with robots, and then I found a bunch of other stuff that's current about robots. So I decided to get too enthused about robots. So, robots in business. Robots start a food delivery service across Ball State. Anybody been to Ball State? Muncie, Indiana? Ball State University. So we have our little electric scooters and stuff. They've got electric carts delivering food on their campus. Food for Ball State University students, faculty, and staff is now rolling across campus through the use of six-wheeled robots that make their way through pedestrian crowds on sidewalks and motorized street traffic to the buildings where hungry diners await. Recently, the university loosed a fleet of 24 robots created by Starship Technologies for food, snack, and drink deliveries from a variety of dining locations on campus. So obviously, this is technology and business. From a marketing viewpoint, it's another channel of distribution. Third P, we'll eventually talk about place. Users can order from their favorite campus dining locations, select a delivery location, or drop a pin where they'd like to meet the robot through the app and have food delivered anywhere on campus. So obviously they're providing customer value of convenience. There is a $2.49 charge for each order, and the robots can only do a single order to one location at a time. But we're seeing our topic for this time period price as a fee in the mix. So how many people think that sounds appealing? Somewhere on campus you'd like to have a robot deliver you food. Would you guys pay $2.49 as a service fee? Yes, yes, yes. So it's worth the convenience for that fee and the price. Who knows Terry Pluto? This was known for a long time as a sports writer. No? Nobody knows Terry Pluto in the newspaper? Who's heard of a newspaper? Anybody know what a news, one, two? I'll go after class about what newspapers were. Terry writes for newspapers. So, ever have a feeling that a robot is following you? Just wait. So here's Terry Pluto's Faith and You. I was looking for distilled water and a few other things at a grocery store named Martin's in Maryland for a few days trip he was going to take. That's when I encountered this strange robot, which you can see in the pictures up there. He's at least 6 feet tall. Later, I learned his name is Marty. He weighs 140 pounds. He costs about $35,000. So there's technology and marketing and price in the B2B side of the mix. I swear he's waiting for me. He had bulging eyes, no arms, no legs. He rolls around. He also has a little mouth with a snarky grin. I don't trust him. Robots are being used to flag hazards, such as liquid powder and bulk item spills, and report when corrective action is needed. The robots help stores to reduce the risk caused by such spills, freeing up store associates to spend more time serving customers. So again, technology and customer service. But he finds stuff all right, says a clerk. He just doesn't do anything about it. He kind of gets in our way. So not everybody loves robots in their workplace and see it as some issues with technology. Then, the more meaty story about this topic. Robots, some companies find only humans can do the job. Robots are the future. In certain sectors, however, that's not anytime soon. So technology adoption and business. Companies have been trying out automatons to serve food in restaurants, make home deliveries, do chores in stores, partly in hopes of easing the worker shortage. But some of these consumer-facing robots are not passing their worker probation period. Among the disenchanted corporations, FedEx said last month it was powering down Roxo, its last-mile delivery robot, to prioritize several nearer-term opportunities. Also in October, Amazon Inc. said it was ending the field test of Scout, its home delivery robot, after learning that some aspects of its unique delivery experience weren't meeting customers' needs. How many of you have anybody encountered a robot in any grocery store, restaurant, walking around anywhere? Yeah, was it an interaction with the robot, or you just saw it?
At Ohio State, they're everywhere.
What do they do there? Just out of curiosity. Delivery food, all right. Did you order anything from it? Okay. And over the summer, DoorDash said it was shutting down its Chowbotics business, best known for Sally, the salad-making robot, roughly 18 months after buying it. So, as always, not all new product ideas work out. Patty, a robot waiter at Fast Casual Change BurgerFi, was introduced in a testing mode in Jupiter, Florida last December, testing their new concept. But nearly a year later, Patty is no longer rolling around BurgerFi's floors. While many customers enjoyed being served by the robot-run waitress, the cost of deploying Patty's to all of the chain's 120-plus restaurants would ultimately have been too high for relatively marginal value. So we talk about marginal cost, marginal revenue, marginal value. We talked about that stuff. We know that profit is equal to revenue minus expenses. If you're getting a marginal value on your investment, is it really worth the investment? In this case, no. Some companies are satisfied the robots are doing the job. White Castle, for instance, has Flippy 2, the latest iteration of a robotic fry cook working the kitchens of four of its 350 fast food restaurants and plans to bring the robots to more than 100 locations. Besides French fries, Flippy can also make onion rings. So we're seeing the adoption of a new product, the robot. And ShopRite, a regional grocery chain, uses Tally robots in 20 of its stores and plans to roll out more of them in the coming months, made by Simbi Robotics. Tally travels the aisles scanning for problems with stock, like items in the wrong place or empty shelves, so we're seeing some more successes along with the failures. But the abandoned tests highlight the difficulties in balancing the costs of robots against their usefulness. Robots are still prone to messing up basic tasks and often require supervision in fluid environments like shop floors or sidewalks. Their success in public settings has been largely limited to high-margin business in contained, predictable spaces, delivering room service at luxury hotels, or mixing cocktails in bars, for example, where robots are often novelties for which companies can charge an extra price in a defined space. Contained activity is very simple to do. So there's, again, price in the mix, a fee for the service. In a different approach, McDonald's is investing in a different form of robots, if you will, bots, software robots. So bots at the software level, testing automated voice recognition that can fill in for human order takers at its drive-thrus. So stay tuned. Let's see if that works or not. Or if you keep talking to it and you keep saying, I'm sorry, I didn't understand you. Can you repeat that? But customers aren't necessarily happy to see a robot when they're expecting a person. Some customers get annoyed. Quit trying to race people, one commentator wrote on Facebook. So you have to understand your target audience and if they'll like it or not. How many people, how many people would be annoyed to be waited on by a robot? The same guy who saw a robot. How many people think it'd be cool, it might be fun? Okay, well, you guys have a different positive attitude about it. But one of the factors, the crush factors, of course, is regulation, legal and political factors. In Toronto, for example, last December, they banned delivery robots in part over concerns that delivery robots could block wheelchair access on sidewalks or otherwise get in the way of humans. The prohibition will remain in effect until Ontario's Transportation Ministry establishes a pilot program to research the effects of robots, and the city council decides whether it wants to opt in or not. So regulatory, legal, political, crest, factor, and business. So again, I got a little enthusiastic about robots. Anybody know, fashion students, do we know about the dad sneaker craze? It's been around, yeah, we do. So for you, this is old news, but okay. The hot shoe right now is called a dad sneaker. What do dads think about that? One of the more sought-after sneakers of the moment looks like something my 60-something uncle would wear to mow the lawn. So a current trend that we have to pay attention to in business, in marketing. A pared-back version of the Japanese running brand's ASICS Gel Keanu 14 model. These shoes are mostly silver and gray and a bit clunky, as you can see the picture up there, in shape with mesh paneling along the toe. The sexiest descriptor of this might be drab. So there's the product. And yet, the $180 sneakers sold out with lightning speed when released online in August. They're now being flipped for double their sticker price on resale sites such as Grail. So here's price in the mix and understanding consumer behavior. These pedestrian shoes are a continuing echo and a loud one at that of the dad sneaker movement. This trend for bulky, bland sneakers has resulted in $1,000-plus gargantuan sold shoes from luxury labels like Balenciaga and Gucci. So again, tracking trends, what's it mean for us? What about different market segments out there? Not everybody's paying $1,000 for clunky dad sneakers. And of course, price in the mix. For millennials and Gen Z, these sensible shoes are an atypical choice that's central to their appeal. The trend is a descendant of the norm core, the 2010s phenomenon of dressing in banal clothing that bucked the prevailing styles, so changing consumer tastes. Despite having a did-you-get-those-at-Payless look, a series of blocky New Balance 550 sneakers made in collaboration with New York brand Leon Dore, have become inescapable in American cities and now fetch upward of three times their sticker prices on the resale market. So my comment, snide comment at that, fashion, go figure. Michael Fuss, an ASICS wearer for over 15 years, had few deep theories on why the brand was basking in the adulation of sneakerheads now. To each his own, right, said the 50-year-old engineer in Boise, Idaho. But he did wonder aloud about their price going up. That's always a concern, right? As things become more popular, they become more expensive. Well, supply, demand, and price relationships we've been thinking about. So that is a second topic. So the fashion students who know about dad shoes, do you guys have any, do your classes, your profs, yourself have any theories on why consumers are going for dumb dad shoes? Hold on, I thought she was going to wave me off. No, we don't know anything. Let's see what we can learn from the fashion side of the house on dumb dad shoes. to hearing on your side.
Well, I think that personally it just goes along with, there's a lot of vintage revival right now.
Okay.
And I feel like dad shoes came back a while ago, but they're coming back again in more of like an 80s style.
Okay.
Yeah, that's
all right.
What I think personally.
All right, interesting, interesting.
Yeah, anything chunky? I think it's also part of the fugly look.
Fugly, see, I haven't been fashionable today.
Thank you.
I don't know.
Thank you.
I don't know.
I appreciate that.
What do I know? What it means? I should be quiet at this point. Shh, shh. All right, lecture notes page 202, and page 368. I'll go look it up later and explain it to myself after class. All right, thank you. I appreciate that. All right, sorry about that. If I said anything inappropriate, because I'm old. So we're now on the second chapter on pricing. This is chapter 14, the setting the final price. And a while ago, you may have seen this a while ago, slide from the beginning. So we're at chapter 14, arriving at the final price, lecture notes pages 203. This next little piece went around a while ago and has come back recently as sort of a social media thing. So here's an example of the influence of price and okay, place and brand name on consumers' perceptions, their feelings. See if you knew about this and if you recognize how interesting it is when we think about price in the marketing mix.
The experiment making headlines by the chain Payless Shoes. They held a grand opening of a luxury store with a different name but the same shoes and charged hundreds more for those same shoes. Customers paid. Here's ABC's Kana Whitworth.
Behold, Palessi.
We built a fake luxury store in Los Angeles and filled it with Payless Shoes. The guests at our grand opening party had no idea.
Guests invited to check out what looked like a luxury shoe shop.
They're elegant, sophisticated.
I just think it's so classy.
And I could tell it was made with high quality material.
A $35 shoe going for $645, an 1,800% markup. Store owners sat on their heels as fashion influencers emptied their wallets.
I would pay $400, $500, yeah. People are going to be like, where'd you get those? Those are amazing.
Then they're let in on the prank.
These are actually from Payless.
You've got to be kidding me.
Shut up. Are you serious?
But those shoppers were refunded their money and they got to keep the shoes.
David, Payless calling it a provocative social experiment designed to challenge today's image-conscious culture. Either way, it was an effective PR stunt.
Yeah.
David.
Clearly a marketing ploy, but they paid. Kana, thank you.
A marketing ploy. Well, it was a marketing event. So it's interesting then how price, along with other things, affects the consumer's perception of what they're seeing. And they were in a fancy, you know, mall front or storefront, and it did have a fancy name with a fancy price tag. Wow, it must be worth it. Price has an interesting impact on consumers' perceptions. So, there are six steps in setting price. We've already taken a look at the first of these, identifying pricing constraints and objectives, estimating demand and revenue, determining cost, volume, and profit relationships. We just covered that last week, yeah? So now we're on to the next step, six steps. Setting an approximate price level, setting the list or quoted price, and then making special adjustments to that list or quoted price. That's what we'll be spending time on next. So let's think about the possible range of prices we could set for a product. Just using a little logic or economics, what's the absolute minimum price you could possibly charge? And I don't mean zero, but I mean logically charge for a product. What's the lowest price you could charge? Yeah. Whatever it costs to make it, mind you, you aren't contributing anything to the overhead, which we talked about last time, those other expenses, those fixed costs, but the minimum you got to charge is what it costs to make it. Good point. Thank you. All right. Now, what's the maximum? What's the maximum price you can possibly charge on a logic basis? What's the most you can logically charge? Seems like something we want to know. Yeah. The most the customer will pay for it. And if we're being honest about it, not ripping them off, that would be the full value of the thing. This example I see. This example, oh yeah, it's on the screen. This example comes from a case that we did a while ago with MBA students. It was a non-consumer situation. Anybody in construction? We have construction management here sometimes. Construction? Oh, you are in construction management. So I don't know what I don't know their major and what they're teaching here. But if you're going to build a building, construct a building on a sandy or a soft soil environment, do you know what you have to do for the foundation? Do they talk about that at all? Okay. What you have to do is you have to drive big metal beams into the ground called piles, and you drive them in with something called a pile driver. So there's my pile driver example up there, pounding these big metal supports into the ground, yeah? If you are in construction industry, you don't own that equipment. You rent it. So you're paying hourly to rent the equipment, which is not inexpensive, plus the crew that comes with the equipment. So as you're pile driving things into the ground, you don't want the metal pile driver pounding on this metal beam. So you had asbestos, this is a long time ago, asbestos is no longer a good thing to use, asbestos pads. Individually, these pads were not that expensive, but they didn't last all that long. So as a construction manager, you were constantly having to stop the pile driving, pull the pile driver out, tip it back or pull it back, change out the pads, put in a new set of pads, and redo it. On a big job, you're paying all that extra time for that pile driver, all that extra time for crew. So if you looked at it, at the whole, it was actually quite expensive to use these not very healthy, not very safe, asbestos pile pads. So a company came up with some cushion pads that were patented and would last a very long time on the job. You wouldn't have to constantly stop, hold the crew up, hold the equipment up over and over and over again. The question was, what could you charge for this new form of pad? And that was a little tricky for them. So at the absolute minimum, what could they charge? Well, we've already answered that and it's on the board. Minimally, you got to charge what it cost you to make the thing, right? The tricky part for the case was trying to convince a manager on the ground what the true value was if you counted in all the time and effort and money they spent on the pile driver, and that was the tricky part of it. So the absolute top, the absolute maximum, was that full value to the customer. And the way the case plays out, you're not possibly going to convince people on the ground to spend that much money, the full value, but you could use a little rationale to explain why it was worth more. So in any of the things you're doing, the minimum, you better at least cover the cost of making it. The maximum, whatever the value is to the customer. And then you're just playing with where is it in between. So let's take a look at some ways of thinking about and setting our initial price, yeah? There's a bunch of categories here, and we're going to start with the category of price approaches based on our thinking about demand. And the first of these is called price skimming. Here, we're going to set the highest initial price that customers who really desire the product are willing to pay. So those are those innovators who really think that this is cool beans and want it right away. So we use it when we're introducing a new or innovative product that people really think is, some people think is really nice. So we typically see price skimming early in the stage, introductory stage of the product life cycle. For the visual learners, we have the price and the cost and over time. And price skimming is going to occur way here early in the whole cycle. And we're going to price high relative to our costs. The cost curve is downward falling to the right to make the point that I've chatted about in passing previously that you know from operations management. Every time you double the production of a product, your price drops by 15 to 20%, depending what industry you're in. Economies of scale, learning curve issues, less waste, etc. So over time, your costs are going down and down, and as long as you can keep that price high relative to those costs, because people really want the thing, it's still new, competitors haven't come in yet, you're making nice fat profit. So costs go down over time with longer and longer production runs and more experience. And so we skim. We create significant profits as we drop our price in steps, but still keep it very high above our cost curve. price skimming, one approach. So if this works for you in your market and your target audience, you have a situation where you can rapidly recover those costs of developing the new product. Can you think back to our product life cycle? And we saw the product life cycle, we saw the profit curve, and what was the profit curve during our development of that new product? How does that play out? What's the profit as we're developing it? Before we sell it? Negative. There's nothing there. So we want to get that money back as soon as we can. So if price skimming works for your product in your market, you begin to rapidly cover those investments with that revenue. It works because, well, consumers really want that product. It's really cool. There are no competitors yet. You're the innovator. And you have some protection on the product. Copyright or patents, there's a unique process, so the competition can't jump in right away. So as a result of these factors, there's no easy substitutes, and so we have something we just talked about last time, an inelastic demand curve. High price, demand doesn't drop that much. Now, while we can not only recover our development costs quickly, if the price is perceived as being too high in the marketplace, it's pretty easy for you as a marketer to drop it down. Customers are not really fond of you rolling out a new product and saying that it costs $699 this week and it's $899 next week, right? That's not something that you're going to make friends with your customers about. So you can always roll it down. Apple, with its original Apple iPhone, quickly dropped the price of its original iPhones because initial sales were less than expected. They dropped them from $599 to $399. Did that make people happy? 50-50 chance of being right. Yes, but also, did that make some people unhappy? Who would be unhappy? The people that just bought it for $5.99. Now, they're not exactly fools, and what they did do was offer up some coupons, discounts on other equipment, they would still make money, for those people that previously bought it and now is a lower price. But they lowered the price because demand wasn't where they thought it would be. A disadvantage of price skimming is, I've said before, what does competition look around and see? You are making a boatload of money selling whatever this thing is. And as soon as they see you're making a bunch of money, they want to say, what can I do to satisfy that market better than they are and make money as well? So you're literally attracting competition. And indeed, after the iPhone rolled out, we saw a whole bunch of additional competition coming out in that domain, right? Another demand-oriented approach that you might think about, depending on your market and your product and your target audience, is penetration pricing. This is the opposite approach to setting your initial price. You're going to set a low initial price on a new product. What should that do if your product's any good? It should jump right over the innovators to the mass market. Wow, I can get that thing at that price. Give me some of that. So they get very excited about it. So you're able, if things go to plan, to capture a large share of whatever that market is pretty quickly. And it only costs you that much to buy. So why would you use this? Well, first of all, there's no real barriers to competition. It's easy to get into and do whatever you're doing. So you don't want to encourage people to come in. And you have to expect the product life cycle to be fairly long, right? Why? Because you're only making a little bit on every one you sell. It's going to take a while to get back the development costs, the marketing costs. You expect it to be a fairly long product life cycle. If it declines too quickly, you didn't get a chance to make back your money. Also, from a demand viewpoint, we expect the demand to be elastic. We expect there to be more purchases, more demand at this lower price point than there would have been at the higher price point. If it's not elastic, you aren't going to get any more demand. Just charge a higher price, right? So you expect it to have an impact on the demand. So for the visual learners, here's our I'll be right back with you. I think my voice is changing. And at my age, too. So So here's our cost curve, dropping down over time. We set the price low initially, and what do we do over time as our costs drop? We drop our price down too. So you're only making a little bit on each one you sell, but you're selling a lot of them, is the thinking. Okay? So this small margin is likely to discourage competition. How's he making money on that? How's he getting any profit out of it? And because you quickly get a large share of the market, your production volume should be larger. Your market share is larger, of course, and your production volume should be larger, so your production costs per unit are going to drop down very quickly. And with that high volume, you're selling a lot of those things, you'll generate a good profit. So the competition should have problems coming in. Even though there's not a lot of barriers to competition, you're out there, your unit prices are dropping down very quickly. As you get more and more experience, more economies of scale, should make it hard for them to come in. Now, it's a risky strategy. Obviously, you got to do a good job of predicting that demand, because you're going to need to be ready to gear up fast for the mass production and mass distribution and mass marketing of the product. If that doesn't work, again, you weren't making much money and things aren't playing out. You aren't getting the volume you need. If demand doesn't develop, our production costs don't drop down, and we don't make any profit. So, not a good plan if that turns out to be the case. So forecasting is important. Another approach based on demand expectations is called slide down the demand curve. Slide down the demand curve. This involves starting with a price skimming approach, keeping it high relative to our initial costs, and then reducing, sliding down our price as our costs decline. So what would we be doing here, theoretically? We're going to appeal early on to that innovator who really, really wants us, and we're going to satisfy that market, and then we'll move it down over time as others come into the market, consumers, or if competition is coming in pretty quickly, we're going to drop our price down towards our cost curve to avoid the competition. So for the visual learners, here we are. Here's our cost curve dropping down to the right. Initially, you see, we're skimming. And then we get a lot of profit, competition comes in, or those innovators are satisfied. So we reduce our price as the premium innovator market is satisfied and as competition enters. Same logic as before. Our cost should be way lower than theirs. We have a lot more production experience. Should be hard for them to catch up. Yeah? So the advantage of the slide down the demand curve is it allows us to recover our development costs early in the product life cycle, and it helps discourage competition as we drop our price. We've already made the point our costs should be lower than theirs as they come into the market later. That assumes a reasonably long product life cycle, because again, as you drop your prices down, you're making less and less profit. It's hard to know just when to begin dropping prices. If you drop your prices too soon, you're giving up profit. And, of course, the other logic applies. If you drop them too late, you're inviting competition to come in. So, obviously, somebody better have their eyes on the marketplace, what's going on with the demand, and have a good plan for when to drop the price point. Another demand-oriented pricing approach related a little bit to our pay less shoe example, sort of, is prestige pricing. It involves setting a high price to attract quality conscious or status conscious consumers. I assume everybody going to the pay less shoe event was looking for status or quality. So this should appeal to high-end consumers, and by costing so much, by having a prestige price point, it limits its appeal to all those other people that can't afford it, which makes it more attractive to the prestige seeker, right? If you're wearing a real Rolex watch, not a knockoff that you got on the corner, not a lot of other people in the room are wearing a real, depending where you hang out, what room you're in, wearing a real Rolex watch. So you got the prestige. You're wearing a Timex, really? Forget about it. So here's the idea of prestige pricing. The notion is expensive must be good, as we saw in the Payless example. So we set our prices high, and we keep them high. And over time, our costs drop, and we're still high. Lots of companies do this stuff. Emporio Armani, Rolex, BMW, Prada, Bugatti. And how's that work? Well, a newcomer is going to have a lot of problems building up the brand image to be one of those brand names, right? Hey, come buy a Marx watch. What? Now, because of the high price, we're really not going to sell a lot of them. Remember our first day example of the car selling for $1.2 million or $2.3 million or whatever? They sold out of them. They don't have to sell too many. So it's not a problem, as significant profit can be made with a large markup on each of the items sold. So it works out pretty well for them. And it's unlikely competition is going to easily come in and have your prestige, your status. Pricelining, another approach based on understanding demand, involves setting the price of a line of products, each at a number of different specific pricing points. Even if the customers don't really understand, don't really know much about the cost of the products and their features per se, the fact that you have, say, three different price points, you guys are from a good, better, best, you know that concept, good price, better, product, best. So they may perceive there to be a difference based on the price that you're charging. And if the differences in the products, the models, the things you're selling, are not readily apparent or not easily viewed, then price lining helps the consumer to see, understand, perceive that there are differences there, as long as you set your price points noticeably different. If you set them too close together, it all looks the same to them. They say, it's all the same, I'll buy the cheap one. That's not what you're hoping for. You need a gap, perceptual difference, for this to work. This is an actual example from not too long ago for Mitsubishi's LCD projectors. Their good projector, the Mitsubishi HC4000, manufacturer suggested retail price, $1,995. With that price, it makes high-definition 1080p home theater experiences affordable. Well, that's a matter of opinion. With a 4001 contrast ratio and dynamic iris control, it provides crystal clear and finely detailed imaging in racing scenes or film noir. Better is the Mitsubishi HC7800D. It's got stunning 3D performance. Now, if you just look at the two models, you can't tell much difference between them just looking, but here's the features, and it's built into the price as well. Using high-precision conversion original 3D glasses with high-speed liquid crystal shutters, which delivers amazing performance both in 2D and 3D, and you'll really be impressed by it. Or, wait for it, best, the Mitsubishi HC9000D at only $69.95. Their 1080p active shutter 3D comes in your home for that low price point of $69.95. That's not its only attraction, though. It offers a great 2D picture, places among the ranks of the finest 1080p home theater projectors available for under $10,000. Note how we anchor the price point of our product. $10,000 is what you could be paying. Ours is only $69.95. Anybody interested? Seems a little above what you and I might be getting. All right, so there's our price lining for some fairly expensive things. Good, better, best, clearly distinctive prices with products that have different features. We see it in the B2B world as well. This is from a little while ago. For PCs, think of Celeron. Celeron, still around, I believe, as being good. Pentium as being better. And Core as being best. Under the Core brand, the i3 represents the entry level of the Core family with Core i5 and Core i7. What are we up to now? i9, I think? Yeah, Matt? i9? So it's a couple generations into the future, but the principle's still the same, representing the mid-level and high-level products. Celeron will stick around for the entry-level computing, Pentium for basic computing, and Atom for devices such as netbooks and smartbooks. So whether you're selling to B2C, B2B, different products, different price points in your mix of product offerings. Here's the impact of Crest Factor on pricing. Intel will raise the price of its CPUs in 2022. Intel has informed its customers that it plans to raise the prices on many of its CPUs and peripheral chip products, and in some cases, the price increases may reach more than 20%. The decision to increase prices stems from the more expensive shipping, labor, and parts costs, as well as inflation. And the amount that the prices will be increased will vary by product and product line. So, what are the advantages of taking this approach? In many cases in manufacturing, you'll find, not always, but often, it doesn't cost that much more to move from good to better or from better to best. The consumers don't know what it costs, and it doesn't cost you all that much. So you may increase profits if the cost of adding those new features, better features, isn't all that significant. And in general, many consumers will buy up to the higher priced product, the more feature-rich model, which is also more profitable for the marketer. So it's a win-win on the marketer side, and the consumer's happy. They're getting good, they're getting better, they're getting best. A disadvantage is that you really have to stay focused on that if you're the marketer or the manufacturer, and by focusing on that, you may overlook other issues that could be quite important to the consumer, like quality or changes in consumers' buying trends. Might just be the wrong focus for you over time. If you use it in a regular practice, it actually may limit your ability to meet competitors' prices. They're smart. They know what your good, better, best prices are. Now they're going to monkey with you by pricing products in between yours. Odd even pricing. This involves setting prices a few dollars or cents under an even number, often 5, 7, or 9. And look at these guys, right? 19.95, 39.99, 69.95. So that is the idea of odd even pricing. Prices that end in 5, 7, or 9 are used for psychological reasons. Consumers tend, despite the fact they're not dumb, they just psychologically tend to say, well, it's 30 some dollars. It's $39.95, it's $40. It's about $30. So they tend to round down rather than round up. Now, on the one hand, we speak out of both sides of our mouth here. On the one hand, they say it's not as considered to be as effective today as it was in the past because consumers have become smarter. We see it everywhere. So they're smarter, but we're still doing it because I think they still believe it. Here it is in cars. Here's 2021 editions of Dave Towell's prices for a Cadillac, $39,365, $44,265, $44,000 to whatever it is, $65,000. We see it all over the place. Here it is for microwave ovens, $99.99, $119.99, $59.99. People round it down in their minds. Target pricing. This is going to be the most objective, rational, logical approach, which means hardly anybody does it. But it's you'll see the logic here in a second. You start by asking yourself, through research and understanding your consumers, how much would consumers pay for this thing? What is the value they would get if we made this thing? So you'd have your retail price point in mind, okay? So you start by estimating the price that the ultimate consumers would be willing to pay for a product because it provides them that much value. Then you go backward in the markup. So retailers get a certain percentage markup, beep. Wholesalers get a certain percentage markup, beep. We need a certain percentage profit. So you work backwards through that chain and deliberately adjust the composition, the features, the costs of the product to get to that target price for the consumers. So rather than turn your engineers loose and say, go build that thing, we'll see how much it costs, you work backwards from how much you think the consumers will pay for it. So the target price minus the markups in the channel minus the profit you want to make tells the engineers what their target costs for this thing should be, a pretty logical approach to demand-oriented pricing. Bundle pricing. We see this a lot in the marketplace. It involves setting the prices for two or more products bundled together as a single price. So if you're a buyer, this means that the overall cost of the purchase of the items will show you a savings compared to if you bought those individually. And for the marketer, you get people to buy your product from you without having to lower the price on either one individually, because it's bundled together. Yeah, it's a lower price, but it's a bundle. So the marketer would fear that lowering the price on one of those things in the bundle would affect consumers' perception of the quality. How come it's that cheap? Also, rather than risk losing the consumer on one of those things that's bundled together to the competition, the marketer captures the full value of that sale. For example, here is Xbox Series 10, I guess, bundled with Assassin's Creed Valhalla. Anybody play Assassin's Creed? And bundled together, it's only $534.98. So you get a savings of $25 if you buy them both at once. Otherwise, you buy the Xbox from me, and then you go buy Assassin's Creed from somebody else, I've lost the sale. So let's give you a reduced cost. Bundle pricing. Yield management pricing involves charging a different price for the same good or service to different markets. You're going to try to maximize your revenue for a set amount of capacity. You only can sell this much of the thing at any given time, and you don't want to lose any sales. For example, you know not everybody on that airplane, even in the same section, paid the same amount of money. Depends on when you bought it, right? Train seats are the same way. Hotel rooms, you know there's not just one set price. They vary by season. They vary by day of the week. And then within any offering, did you get it on Priceline? You probably got it cheaper. Rental cars, the same way. Concert seats, not everybody pays the same price, right? So what makes this work? Well, first of all, it works because there's a fixed amount of resources available for sale. There's only a certain number of concert seats, a certain number of airlines seats, certain number of, where else was I? Hotel rooms. So there's a fixed amount of resources for available, and those resources are perishable. There's a limit to the time that they're good for anything. Hey, you know that concert ticket you wanted for that concert last night? I can get it for you really cheap today. Would you like it? No, dude, the concert was yesterday. But here's the ticket. Go away. So there's a limited amount of time. Selling you a hotel room that for last night is silly. Doesn't mean anything. So they're perishable. And it also requires that different customers are willing to pay a different price for using the same amount of resources. People are willing to pay different prices for airline tickets, hotel rooms, concert seats. I suppose at some point consumers could rise up and say, no, we're not going to do that, but we aren't seeing that happen. Now, we can do it in one of two ways, yield management pricing. One approach, airlines often, but not always, charge more for people who book later on. Why? Vacationers, regular citizens, plan well in advance. They only have a limited budget. They're planning a vacation for a family. They don't want to spend a huge amount of money. Business travelers, who are just going to charge it off to the corporation, often their plans change quickly. They've got to make, you know, a reservation right now. So often, not always, airlines charge more for people who book later, and there's still open seats, of course. I guess we get into how they oversell seats that aren't there. We won't talk about that. Or let's pick on the fashion industry. The fashion industry offers prices the other way around. They charge less. They discount later on in the season. Why? Because it's moving out of fashion. The season is changing. So that really cute swimsuit that you wanted in April for the summer, you aren't that excited to buy it in November for the winter. So we discount it to get rid of it. All right, let's shift our approach from thinking about demand and things that would influence our demand to cost-focused pricing, cost-oriented pricing. One approach that we see fairly often is called the standard markup pricing approach. And what we're going to do is we know our cost, and we're going to just add a fixed percentage to the cost. Often, not always, this refers to retail price. So we know the retail, as a retailer, I know what I paid for it. If you're the wholesaler, you sold to me, I know what I paid. Now I'm going to jack it up by a certain percentage. For example, the markup for new luxury jewelry can be 250 to 300%. So I buy it for $1,000. How much do I then sell it for on the top end here? $3,000. That seems like you're making a lot of money to me. Ignoring the issue of demand per se, from a business model viewpoint, how would we justify them making that much money on the sale of an item of jewelry on a business model side? Any thoughts? I mean, I have an answer in mind that I'll share in a minute. Any thoughts on why that makes sense, not just the prestige side, which is customers, but on the business side? Yeah. Hold on. I can't really hear him. Because of advertising? Could be. That would be a high cost that could jack things up for a piece of luxury jewelry. All right. Could be. Any other reasons why on a business model side this might make sense? Yeah. The underlying cost, well, again, whatever that cost is, we're going to charge $300 more, 300% more. So that's not part of this equation, but thank you. Well, let me ask you this. You're a jeweler in a luxury jewelry shop. Congratulations. How often do you turn your inventory over? That is to say, how fast does that $3,000 necklace sell? Really quickly? It's going to sit there, arguably, for quite a while, drawing attention, waiting for a customer to buy. The turnover is pretty low on an item like that. You better be making money somewhere because you're not going to turn it over very often. It's going to sit there for a long time. So from a business model viewpoint, for something like this, it makes sense that they have to charge and can't charge 300% markup. Services are often set at something like 50% markup over the cost of providing the service. Now, sometimes we use this to refer to the manufacturer setting the wholesale selling price. They know their cost. They'll use a standard fixed percentage markup to set the wholesale price. So it can work elsewhere. So retail price, in our base example, our jewelry store example, is equal to the retail cost plus the markup. If you're working in a retail store and you're helping to set them prices, on the one hand, it's pretty simple, right? You just add a certain markup to what's going on. But of course, things can get confusing. So let's calculate a markup percentage based on this approach. And let's think about the percent markup based on our selling price, okay? So the formula would be our markup on selling price as a percent is equal to our dollars of markup divided by our selling price times 100. So let's think about that markup idea. Oh, we're going to talk about the other approach. Or we can talk about a markup percent based on cost. Markup on cost is equal to the markup dollars divided by the cost. The reason I bring up these two examples is there are examples where somebody is set off as the intern or something to go set prices on all those new products coming in, and they're not clear on where the percentage markup is supposed to be. Is it supposed to be on selling price? Is it supposed to be on cost? You should have done better supervision, by the way, of your staff. But you got to know what you're doing. All right, let's take an example of markup on cost. The cost to me, the retailer, is $36 for each of the products I sell. And the industry markup in my industry for this product is 125% of cost. Yeah? So we know markup on cost is equal to the markup dollars divided by the cost times 100. On the next side, we're going to get rid of that percentage by multiplying things by 100. So 100 on the left, 100 on the right. Divide by it. Divide by it. Did I say multiply? We divide both sides by 100. So we'd end up with, I don't really see the percent sign going away, but that's the principle. Oh, we're good. There it is. We're about to divide by. So 125% divided by 100 is going to get rid of that percent. Is equal to our markup dollars, which we're trying to figure out, divided by our cost, which I just told you is $36 times 100, divided by 100. So after we do the division, we get the 1.25 is equal to markup dollars divided by 36. We're going to multiply both sides by 36, just doing arithmetic. So 1.25 times our $36 cost is equal to what we were trying to find out, our markup dollars, $45, yeah? And so what's our price going to be? We're going to sell it at our cost, $36 plus our 1.25 markup percent, $45. So our selling cost is $81. So here we have the industry markup, 125% of cost based on our $36 cost to us, yeah? Or we can look at it based on the markup on selling price. Staying with the baseline idea, the cost to me is $36 for each of the products I want to sell, and I'm selling the product for $80. So what is my markup on my selling price? Markup on selling price, percent, is equal to markup dollars divided by selling price dollars times 100. Same idea. So the markup itself is the difference between my selling price, $80, and my cost, $36. So my markup is $44. So my markup on selling price percent is $44 divided by $80. That is the markup divided by the selling price times 100, or 55%. So that answers the question, what is my markup on selling price? Another cost-oriented approach is cost plus pricing. In some industries, we add a certain percentage. Retail, jewelry store, add 300%. In other cases, we say that underlying cost, again, where's my construction guy? What's it going to cost me to build that room, that house, that deck for you? Costs are floating around. Labor costs are floating around. Time is, I don't know what it's going to cost, but I tell you what, I'm going to charge you, dear customer, the cost plus a certain amount of profit for me. So that's the idea. I didn't mean to pick on you. That's the idea of adding a cost to the product. We can do it by using a fixed monetary cost. For this job, I'm going to charge you whatever the cost is plus $750 for my time. Boom. I don't know how much it's going to cost for all that other stuff, but there we go. So we can do a fixed monetary amount rather than a percentage. So that's cost plus a fixed fee. Or just to make things complicated, we can do it by adding a fixed percent to that baseline cost, the cost of the manufacturing, the cost of the construction, whatever it might be. Okay? I know I'm rattling things off. We're okay in terms of writing? All right. Another cost-oriented pricing approach is very similar to something we talked about, but here we're focused on cost. And that here is called the experience curve pricing. It's a pricing approach we already considered under another name. It's based on that learning effect that we talked about. Unit costs of many products and services decline by 10 to 30% each time a firm's experience at producing them doubles. Because of the learning curve, because of the lack of waste, because of economies of scale. So this results in the possibility of a rapid price reduction based on not thinking about demand, but thinking about cost. And it suggests the advantages to market leaders. So that is where we saw before, our downward sloping to the right cost curve and our price dropping down with it. Let's switch our attention one more time. So first we talked about demand. Focus. Then we talked about cost focus. Let's now focus on something that's near and dear to many of our hearts, profit, and think about setting price with profit in mind. One approach is to set an annual profit target in dollars. This year we're going to make this much money. Sometimes I need to say, how are you going to do that? But okay. Or you could set a target return on sales. So we set prices to achieve a profit that's a specific percentage of the units sold. Or we have our investors in mind. We see our investors can always go somewhere else and invest their money. Let's set a return on investment. So we set our prices to achieve a specific annual return on investment. All of these are fine and good, but they do ignore the question of demand. So yeah, you want to make that much money, and you're going to charge that amount for the product. Are people going to buy it at that amount? You got to logic this out a little bit. They are interrelated. Competition-oriented pricing. One approach is we're not going to worry about what the pricing is. We're not going to run our own model. We'll set it at whatever the traditional price in that channel for our market is. Whatever the competition sets it at, yeah, that's what we'll use. Or you can use their price as a reference point. And you can set your price relative to their price. So you can set it above their price, if you're lucky enough, by, what, some percent probably? Or at their price, which is pretty much the same as the first one. Or below their price, because your name isn't as big as them. And so you can try to steal from some of their customers at a lower price point, assuming you can satisfy those customers just as well as they can. Here's a tricky one. Loss leader pricing. Here, we are going to set our price below its usual price or even its profitable price. Why in the world would I set my prices below its profitable point? That seems like a sure way out of business. Why would I do that? To gain market share, as long as you can get whatever share you want in a very short run, because very quickly you're going to have a huge amount of sales with a huge amount of loss, maybe. Why else might a place use loss leader pricing? This will be really simple when we get to it. You're going to go, oh, yeah. Or is it already on your sheet? All right. The place we more often see it done is grocery stores. The goal isn't to make money on that item, but to attract the customer's attention with the hope they'll come in and buy other more profitable products as well. So I don't know these days what a 2-liter bottle of Pepsi costs. Let's say it costs, I don't know, $1.89. And you're going to offer it up Friday and Saturday, 99 cents a piece. Whoa. And you aren't making any money on that. 99 cents a piece. I'm coming in and get me some of those. And oh, by the way, I'll get some of my kumquat-flavored ding-dongs and some ho-hos and some Pringles while I'm in the store, right? So that's sort of the hope. So you probably wouldn't use it in the long run, but in the short run, especially if it's working to draw in consumers who buy other things, you're a winner. Costco's. How many guys know Costco's? Everybody? Costco's? How many guys are members of Costco's? Okay, I might see you there sometime. Costco's. Costco's rotisserie chickens are well known as a loss leader, which is defined as merchandise sold at a loss in order to draw customers in. In other words, Costco's is willing to sell those chickens at $4.99 even if they're not making any money them. Why? Because the chances are good that you're not making the trek all the way out to the Costco warehouse just for one chicken. Even if you think you're going to run in and grab a hot rotisserie chicken and beeline it to the registers, how often does that really happen? You remember that you're almost out of laundry detergent, or you see a pair of designer jeans that you totally don't need but are so cheap you have to have them, or you get suckered into buying a 36-pack of sausages because the sample that they gave you was so good. 9 times out of 10, you're leaving Costco with a whole lot more than that $4.99 rotisserie chicken and a whole lot less money in your wallet. Costco might be willing to sell you a delicious chicken for under $5, but they're certainly not doing it out of the goodness of their heart. You're in. You're buying a bunch more stuff. Loss leader. So now we move, having set this initial price, step 5, to setting the list or the quoted price. One approach for a lot of products and some services is to set it as a fixed price. Everybody who buys this is going to pay this amount. So when you go into the grocery store, to continue our example, and you get that gallon of milk, you don't typically, at least in the U.S., stand around and debate with the cashier, how much is that? How much do I really pay for that? You're saying it's $2? Would you take $1.69? That's silly, right? You do bargain for some products, not for groceries. So that's called a one-price policy. Obviously, a lot of products are sold at a particular price point. A flexible price policy, on the other hand, involves setting different prices for products and services depending on the individual buyers and their purchase situations. What pretty big ticket item can you imagine consumers buy? Pretty big ticket, where not everybody buys, pays the same amount for the same product. Anything come to mind? Yeah. Car, right? You pretty much know, I think, it's not usually one set price. Depends a little on your negotiation skills. It depends on how much, if you're going to finance with them or not. It depends on, you're walking in just saying, I'm going to take that one, ooh. Or, you know, I'm going to go look somewhere else, right? So that would be a flexible price policy, also called dynamic pricing, which we're going to get into in much more detail in a bit, not today. So what sorts of things influence that list or quoted price? Well, first of all, what's your business model? What's your company like? If you have different product lines, I assume you're using different pricing approaches for each of your product lines. So you have the product line pricing. Customer effects. Who's your target market? What are they looking for in price? Do they want low price? They want prestige price. Myself and my wife, right? Competitive effects are going to influence that price. If you price inappropriately in your marketplace against competition, you get into a price war. You, either on purpose or not, set your price lower than the competition. They say, wait a minute. I'm not giving Marks this business. I'm going to undercut him. And then I turn around and undercut them. That's great for the consumer. Are we making any money? Probably not. So you want to be aware of what your price says to the competitors. Price war is good for the consumer, not good for business. There are a bunch of special adjustments to list your quoted price, but I think we'll save that for next time. So this will be mini test 11, yes. And midterm 2 is open, yes. And see you next time. Bye.